Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Unlock big savings and add style and security to your home with high-quality Schlage door locks from Menards. Whether you're looking for a traditional interior lock or a Wi-Fi compatible electronic lock, Menards has you covered. With more than 200 options of Schlage door locks in stock, save big on all door locks. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This is our continuing coverage in the trial of Shanda Vander Ark, a twisted story of a mother who depraved her own child of food until the point of death, even employing her oldest son in this torturous charade. We now take you to the courtroom for our continuing coverage.
Timothy Ferguson had become less than the animals that she trains. You heard her say it would never occur to her to do the things that she did to Timothy to the animals that she trains, to the dogs that she trains. He was less than a dog to her. And this was a fight that he was not going to win. But don't take my word for it. July 29th. And even if he sits up right before you get there, or as you get there, I honestly don't care if you get a little rough with him. July 29th again. Trust me, I know he's thin. That being said, he told me a week and a half ago that he wanted to be thin to make me feel bad for punishing him. This is supposedly when he's on his hunger strike. You don't get to grump at him for that, though. I already lit into him for it. Cleaning up the rooms, directing Paul to make sure that he cleans up the rooms. And please check the carpet to see if it needs to clean that too. There's some different awesome cleaner for the carpet that he can use if he needs to. He will need to use a different green and yellow sponge for that. I do not want him using my nice sponges for either of those. July 1st, after the photograph that she's got. Might be best if you give him like 4 pieces of bread to eat before he starts work, just to make sure he stands up while he eats them, please. That way he has no excuses. July 1st. The camera in his room needs to be picked up, please. Ugh, lots of hot sauce for that. What do I do if he doesn't finish within the assigned time? Hot sauce. These are all after that photograph. So apparently this hot sauce isn't just Carolina Reaper, it's the Trinidad Scorpion Chili Pepper. Yep. While he's on a hunger strike, on July 5th, the day before he dies. Forgot to tell you this before I left. Timothy was doing his fake stumbling and falling last night, of course, so I decided to prove once again how fake it is. I asked him if he would stop doing that if he would eat a whole pizza by himself, and he said yes, of course. And then I told him how obvious it was that he was being fake, and he had just proven that yet again, and of course he just looked down and didn't respond. Can't say it any more blunt than she does. She was not going to let Timothy win. Plain and simple. And if that many died, then many died. He dies, she kicks into survival mode, and starts to lie to the police. That alone evidences a guilty state of mind, ladies and gentlemen, but you don't need that. You don't need much more than these text messages to prove that Shonda Vander Ark is responsible because she intended to kill, because she intended to do great bodily harm, or she at least created a situation so dangerous that death or great bodily harm was a result to her child, Timothy Ferguson. And I will ask you to return a verdict of guilty, a first-degree felony murder, a first-degree child abuse. Thank you.
Mr. Roberts. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Yeah. Everybody ready? Need a moment? You're all good? Okay. I'm a child of the late 50s and grew up in the 60s and 70s. And during that period of time, and even the 80s and 90s, when you remember something, it was in your head. It was something that was up here and a memory was up there. And that's where the memories were. That's where we kept them. And it was a great system because they're all there, and if called upon to respond to a memory, a situation, an issue, the entire memory and its context will come tumbling out. Then we started doing something in the aughts and the 10s and the 20s where we started having these devices called cellular phones. And in those cellular phones, they have this thing on them called text messaging, where you can write down whatever's going through your head at the moment and send it. It's a great system. Let's face it, we all use it because it works, and it works well, and it's very utilitarian, and we love it. But I think if we had a chance to think about it, we'd all admit that what you text isn't everything that's going on. That what you text doesn't tell the whole story. The text you sent today don't tell the whole story of your whole day. They tell a portion of it. They tell a snippet. They tell a story. But they probably don't tell what happened to you from the time you got up and you couldn't find your left shoe to the time you're going to go to sleep tonight and wishing you had an extra slice of that pie for dessert. It doesn't tell you all that stuff, right? It tells you a snippet. It tells you a bit. It doesn't tell if you're mad or you're kidding or you're suggesting or you're tired or you, yeah. You didn't check spell check before you sent it, so it says go when you want to say goat. It doesn't tell any of that stuff. It tells you a snippet. It tells you a portion. It tells you a particle. And that's what text messages do. The greatness of text messages are they're great. It's in the message. The weakness of them are is they don't tell the whole story. And if someone were to grab someone's phone and look at what they did from a year and a half ago and try to figure out what they were thinking based on their text, they'd know that snippet, but they wouldn't know this is I'm venting. They wouldn't know that I don't take this serious. This is I don't mean this seriously. They wouldn't know that even though I'm mad at you, I still love you, because that's the part in the text is going to be you didn't clean your room. And that's it, because that other part isn't with it. The other part, our communication, even when I speak to you right now, our communication is the words that come out of my mouth are only about 35% of what your information you're taking in. You're watching my body language. You're listening to the sound of my voice. You're listening to the context. You're looking at the situation. That fills in the other information that you're going to need to have in order to figure out with the most powerful computers that the known to man, our brains, what I really mean and what I'm really saying. If you have If you have, all you have is a text. Ladies and gentlemen, it's like watching a movie with no picture. All you hear is the voices in the background. Somebody has to explain to you what else is going on in that scene. That's what we have here. We have a series of texts. We have a series of texts that people can select and jump around in terms of not just time, times and dates and times of day, and without reflection on the circumstances. You're at work. You have time to send a 3-second text before the judge calls you and says, come do something else. Or you're sitting in your living room, you're reading a book, and you can take your time with these texts. It doesn't tell you any of that. So what comes out to you is a distorted picture. My suggestion, someone takes your text, what comes out to you is a distorted picture. It's not the whole story. It's not the whole situation. It doesn't tell the whole thing. All the texts that you've written do not tell you the whole story of your life. It tells you what they refer to that moment, and that's it. And the rest has to be inferred. If someone comes along and takes it out of context, and takes it out of circumstances, and it takes it out of where it existed at the time you sent it, you have a different story than what was intended. The communication you're getting is different than what you intended. That's problem number one. Problem number two is when you take those texts and you back them up with somebody who's highly motivated to lie. Ladies and gentlemen, they didn't have supercomputers back when they invented the theory of relativity. When Einstein, he didn't have a supercomputer. They hadn't been invented yet. What Einstein used to do famously, he used to call them thought experiments, where he'd imagine a situation and then he tried to think his way through. He was pretty good at it. He kind of changed life on the planet. He kind of changed life on the planet. Now, you've been told that Paul's deal was that he had immunity from prosecution for whatever he talked about, and he'd get a sentencing recommendation or something like that, and there was one other thing, I forget, it doesn't matter. There's 3 things you were told he said. He's charged with child endangerment, child abuse in the first degree. Okay. And you were told that by our judge, that you can believe all of what somebody says, part of what somebody says, or none of what somebody says. You were told that was Paul's deal. I'm going to invite you to it. And that Paul could be charged with first-degree murder, which Paul told you from the stand. I asked him, do you know what the penalty for that is? I sure do. He could be charged with first-degree murder. I want you to do this thought experiment. You're a lawyer. You're Paul's lawyer in this thought experiment of my making. And the prosecutor calls you and say, I want to use your client to testify against his mom. And you say, okay. And then you have the client testify. And then he testifies, he does everything he's required to do, everything he wants, they want it. He gives them everything he could, he gives them. And then at the end, once he's done testifying, his lawyer finds out they've charged his client with first-degree murder anyway. After all, that wasn't part of the deal, right? He could be charged with first-degree murder. Paul could be, theoretically, it's not part of the deal, could be charged with first-degree murder, even though he's fully performed. What would, in this thought experiment, what would your reaction be that you sent your client in, he did everything he was told, and he still gets charged with first-degree murder? Might I suggest to you that you might be a little upset with that? Might I suggest to you that if you were informed that after Paul has performed and you're his lawyer and he's still being charged with first-degree murder, that you're going to be upset. And I further suggest that you're going to tell everybody, you're going to tell all of your defense friends, all your defense lawyers, you're going to tell them, this is what they did to me. When do you think the prosecutor is going to get another defense attorney to serve their client up again, if you did that? When do you think they're going to get another defense attorney in this county and be a thought experiment to serve up their client if he does what he's supposed to do and he still gets charged in the circumstances like we've described? Well, you know what the answer is. You know what the answer is. In your thought experiment, you can figure out this is what is not going to happen. Because you know what's going to happen when the defense community is going to find out what happened with Paul and his testimony. Did what he's supposed to. Still got charged with first degree murder. Did what he's supposed to. He's not going to be able to get, the prosecution is not going to get another defense attorney to come forward and give up their client again. This is part of something that's obvious, and it doesn't have to be in writing. Everybody, if you do the thought experiment, it's in writing. It's not in writing, but you can do the thought experiment. You can bet your house Paul's not going to get charged with first degree murder. You can bet your house that Paul's deal is not his immunity. Paul's deal is that no first degree murder. That's his deal. Paul is highly motivated to tell you the story that will keep him from getting that charge. And he did. Read those, his own text. Paul's the one who's talking about, I wish I could beat him up. I've never wanted to beat up somebody more in my life. Paul's the one who kicked in the door. Paul's the tormentor. Paul is the guy who's not only tormenting his brother, he's also enjoying it. And Paul is motivated to say now. And Paul, Paul testified against his mom. Paul tortured his brother. That's who Paul is. And Paul ain't going to be charged with first degree murder. I don't care what the deal is. I think that should be obvious. So you got the two bits. You've got these text messages that give you a false and misleading representation of what people are thinking. You've got Paul sitting here talking for his life, talking his butt off. He's trying to get out from under. In fact, at one point I asked him, isn't it true you wrote a letter to your mom saying you wish you just ended all so you could get out of this thing? And he said, yes, I did. That's who Paul is. Paul's also the nexus of information for my client. Yes, my client, he told my client one time that he thinks he's thin, we should feed him, but on another time, in fact, right before his death, Paul says, no, he's fine. Paul is the nexus of information. If you have those cameras, these security cameras in your home, you recognize those are great devices, and generally speaking, they do the job. But the kind of detail, the kind of vision that you really need Paul there to augment that so that you get a full picture of what's going on. And Paul was there, and he was providing for my client. Third factor. I got a client that forgot everything. She forgot her name, if you were asking. She forgot everything, just basically. Okay. When Mr. Roberts was giving his open, and quite frankly, I've been doing this for 35 years. That's one of the finest openings I've ever heard. It was just wonderful. It was those kinds of things that lawyers appreciate because it was so well crafted and so well delivered. And he even gave you some poetry, and I'm no poet. I can't match that. I look for stuff, but I can't find anything like he did. It was just a wonderful opening. What I got for you is a little bit of physics. About 20 years ago, 30 maybe, I read that the smallest bit of matter theoretically possible to exist in the universe would be about 2/100,000 of a billionth of a millimeter. And it would be a thing. It'd be two-dimensional. It'd be a thing that's so high energy that it could only exist for a brief moment in time. It comes, it exists, and it pops out of existence again. I read that 30 years ago. I couldn't tell you the first name or last name of any of the people in this panel right now. It's not because it's not important. It's because that's the way memory works. I couldn't tell. That's the way memory works. It is not a logical construct where you remember things that you're supposed to, but you can forget the things you don't. Memory remembers what it wants to remember. Now you can do techniques and training to do, and if something say is say someone calls a lot of adrenaline or something that burns the memory into you. You remember that. You remember when your child was born. Because that's the sort of situation it is. But otherwise, memory has its own mind. And it remembers what it wants and it forgets what it wants. And to say, well, she didn't remember these things. Well, yeah, she probably doesn't. You know, we talked about, and to use Mr. Roberts' example, at one moment my client is talking about getting fries for the younger child, but getting hot sauce for the older child. And he talks about compartmentalizing. The brain is a sophisticated organism, it's a sophisticated panel. It will organize things according to whatever parameters that are there, but it will separate things out. And it is my argument. The argument we've made from the very beginning is that while she, part of her knew she was punishing this boy, none of her knew that she was hurting him. I understand. There's two possibilities. One, she's exactly what Mr. Roberts said, and that's evil. That's evil. Or the other possibility is there's something going on and she doesn't understand. She didn't understand, despite all the intelligence, she didn't understand the ultimate consequences of those individual acts of punishment. The accumulated force and power and weight of those individual acts of punishment. She didn't understand it. She didn't see it. I don't know how that could be. But to be honest with you, that's what makes sense. It makes sense because this is her son. And that would be, and she raised other children, her own flesh and blood. She raised them and never, and didn't do this sorts of things to them. Something was going on where she didn't understand it. This child was probably the highest needs. She didn't understand it. And this, and her personal situation also makes a difference. She took this child in when she wasn't supposed to have him because there was no other choice. So she did it. She raised another child. Paul has special. Paul's 20 years old and living at home with mom and working minimum wage. This is what Paul's doing. She has other child, and she has the demands of judges and lawyers, and she has demands of education and the demands of ambitions, and her husband gets a stroke. These all make a difference. That's what I'm talking about, context. Giving four slices of bread with hot sauce on it doesn't talk about, she's thinking about her husband, the impact, this is, how she's going to pay the rent, how she's going to get to work tomorrow, there's no gas in the car. These are all things that are going. There isn't a situation where she's sitting there just thinking about this one problem. She has too many problems to think about one. She's thinking about them all at a time. And pressure busts a pipe. It was too much. She didn't hate her child. That's what it would have taken to knowingly do this to your child. She would have to hate him. A child makes you angry. A child makes you frustrated. A child makes you tired. A child is willful, and this is and she wasn't able to cope with it, and she didn't add it up. The bread plus the water plus the standing against the wall. She didn't add it up, and the mind is a powerful thing. She didn't see what we all saw, but let me. So, this woman who doesn't love her son, according to the people, comes into a room and she says, Timothy, please, no. Wake up. Come on, buddy. No, 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 no. This can't happen. Is he okay? Is he okay? He's not stiff. Please, baby, come on. Open his jaw for me. Please, come on. Come on, buddy. You're okay. Come on, buddy. Come on, Timothy. I don't understand. To which Paul says, I don't either. Come on, buddy. Come on, sweetie. Come on, buddy. Come back to us. Come on, buddy. Come on, buddy. Come on. Does she get scared on her? Yep, and lie to please. Hell yeah. She does. A lot. Because like Paul, she can see it now. Now, she doesn't have to do the math. The math is the body of her dead son. And they can both see it now. But as they were going through it, folks, they didn't see it. I don't think at the moment that they find the body and they says, I don't understand. And Paul says, I don't either. They were faking it for the camera or faking it for the police. They've forgotten all about the damn camera. They said those things because that was true. It's what you do in those moments of high stress. It's true. I didn't get this. I didn't see this coming. How could you not? They didn't. They didn't see it. Neither one of them saw it. Paul talked about, in his few moments of clarity, I love my brother. I wish it was me instead of him. And that's how, did he start feeling that way afterward? Or did he feel that way at the time? If he felt that way at the time, how could he do these things? Because he didn't know he was doing these things. You see where I'm going? How could he feel, I repeat, he said he'd give his life for his brother if he could. Question is, did he feel that way at the time he was doing these things to him? Well, how could he do those things to him if he felt that way? Because they didn't see it. These people committed manslaughter. That's what they did. They caused this boy's death, but they didn't intend to. That's simply it. We're asking that you, when you do your deliberations, that you consider that. I understand those pictures look like. I understand they look like. I understand that everybody here wants justice for Timothy. I get that too. Justice is the conviction of a person for what they did, not for what they made us angry about, not what they made us sick about, not what they made us want to jump over that railing and take care of this thing ourselves. That's not what justice is. Justice is, this is what you did, and this is what you'll pay for. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Because I do bear the burden of proof in this case, I do get one more opportunity to address you. And I don't want to start by thanking Mr. Johnson for his compliments here. We tried a number of cases together over the years, and it's always, quite frankly, it's always a pleasure to work with Mr. Johnson. And I think a lot of folks are probably confused sometimes when they see a relationship, a good relationship between both sides. And what I always tell people is, this is an adversarial system by its nature, but that doesn't mean that the parties necessarily have to be adversaries. We don't have to agree on everything, and ultimately, that's why you folks are here. Let's start with Mr. Johnson's comments about the text messages and how text messages don't show all of what a person is doing. He's right. They don't show all of what a person is doing or necessarily even what a person is thinking. But they do offer a window into the insight of what a person is thinking about. They do offer a window into what a person is telling somebody else to do or telling somebody else to say. So the fact that there are that binder full of text messages over a six-month period about what to do to punish Timothy offers you a window into the inside of the defendant. But actions are what speaks louder than words here. Because everything that she talked about, everything that she wanted to have done, with the exception of one thing, so out of bounds, I can't even believe she posed it, but everything that she wanted to have done was done. That's not text messages, that's her actions. Her actions, not her text messages, caused Timothy's death. Her actions, not her text messages, caused Timothy to suffer serious emotional, mental, and physical harm that resulted in his death. Withhold the food. Give him bread with hot sauce. Put him in an ice bath. Make sure he doesn't sleep. Make sure all the food is locked up. Make him run the stairs. It goes on and on and on and on. Her actions speak louder than her words. Mr. Johnson talked to you about Paul. And I'll leave you to your recollection of what Paul's deal was, but Mr. Johnson summarized it fairly well. There is not an agreement in place that Paul is not charged with murder in this case. Ultimately, that's a decision that our office gets to make. So he wants you to look at Paul's testimony through that lens. Go ahead. Please do. What did Paul lie about? What did Paul get on the stand and tell you that wasn't true? What did Paul get up there and describe what he had done to Timothy at Shonda's direction that didn't happen? Nothing. Mr. Johnson cited nothing for you to look at in Paul's testimony that wasn't true. And he can't, because everything Paul talked about that he did is verified by the text messages. Every single one of them. And again, the only thing he didn't do, and he's the one that drew the line, the only thing he didn't do was when the day before her child dies, as she's looking at him in an ice bath for hours upon end, and says, hey, crazy idea, what would it feel like if hot sauce was poured on your private parts? I'm not saying touch him there or anything, but what do you think? Are you kidding me? That's why I said yesterday, did you even need to ask that question? What do you think? That's what's in her mind. That's how you determine what her intent is. That's what the instructions are going to tell you to do. This isn't a tiny glimpse of her. This isn't a tiny moment in time, and you can't assume that that's what she is. You can assume that's what she has done for the last 6 months. Because that's what this is about. That's what these text messages are about. Every single one of them. Right up until the very end. The last thing she says to Paul before they find Timothy that next morning is, I had to drag him back into the small room. He decided to go big or go home today. The last thing she says to her child, you don't have to breathe with your mouth open, dummy. Her actions, what makes her guilty? The text messages are just evidence to support the actions that she took. Paul aided and abetted in the death of his brother. There's no question about that. He did these things. But you saw Paul. You heard him talk about what limitations he has. You heard him talk about what type of person he was. But you know what Paul is not? Paul is not Timothy's father. Paul is not the person charged with the care and custody and love of his brother. He can love him. And as he said, I guess I didn't love him enough. It's up to you whether you believe that was genuine or not, but even if you believe it wasn't, even if you believe his emotion about this and his remorse about this is fake, he didn't lie about anything else. It's all proven. And let's just assume for the sake of argument that Paul is the mastermind behind all of this. Paul's responsible for everything. Why do you leave him alone with him? If you're the parent, why are you leaving your child alone with somebody who's this monstrous? It doesn't make any sense. The reason Paul is left to watch over him is because Shonda can manipulate Paul into doing the things that she needs to have done. She knew she had somebody in Paul that would carry out her instructions implicitly. I'm glad she stopped Paul from being physical with Timothy. I am. I appreciate that the one thing he did not actually have to suffer as a result of this were beatings. But everything else was just to isolate Timothy from the world. Look at the lengths she went to make sure that the grandmother of the youngest child couldn't come to the home. To the point where she's tracking her on her phone when she's driving home from work. Now, I don't like it when my in-laws come over and my house is dirty, but But I'm not looking at my phone to see when they're going to get here or make sure I meet them outside so they don't come inside. You only do that because you're trying to hide something. What is she trying to hide? She's trying to hide Timothy. Because anybody that would have seen Timothy, anybody that looked at that child would have known what was going on. And she couldn't have that. And her mind is working well enough to know, I can't have people seeing Timothy. I can't have photographs of Timothy. I need to have Paul do these things. I need to make sure that Timothy doesn't get to go outside. Did you hear her say anything about anywhere that Timothy got to go? The closest she came to saying, well, the backyard is kind of open and you can kind of see in the backyard. She talked about taking him to Craig's Cruisers or taking him to a movie or taking him to a restaurant, any of that stuff? No. Timothy was a prisoner, treated lower than a human, treated lower than an animal in his own home. A prisoner in his own home. The 911 call. She said all those things. You heard all those things. I'll leave it to you to determine whether or not the emotion that she's displaying there was real. Sounds cold. Yeah, she's upset. She's upset that he's dead. But if you're so worried, if you're so concerned, if you're so alarmed, if you care so much about this person, why do you wait 18 minutes to call 911? Why, when your son, who's 20 years old, says to you, I think we need to call an ambulance, or should we call an ambulance? You say, no, not yet. Not yet? Not yet? When? When you're done making it sure, like, you're covering up as much evidence as possible? Because that's when. Because then it becomes a matter of making sure he's got pants on and put your belt on to make sure he looks, that he's looked this way. Make sure we tell him he was on a hunger strike. And now I guess we'll have to call 911. Not yet. Don't call 911 yet. What are you waiting for? Got to get the story straight. I guess I'm going to be late for work. You heard Paul up here yesterday say that he'd trade places with Timothy if he could. Did you hear the defendant say that? No. Mr. Johnson said she had so many things on her mind, this was just one thing too many. He's right. Timothy was the one thing too many. Timothy was too much for her. And as a result, she decided she wasn't going to lose this fight. Timothy was too much for her to handle, but she was going to win. And again, don't take my word for it. February 16th, 5 months before Timothy dies. I may need some help with it, but I'm about to get a lock for the pantry door. Remember what she said about the pantry? And a lock for the fridge and both freezers, and then we won't leave any food out in those areas, and he won't have access to unlock those. This is supposedly February 14th. This is when he's on a hunger strike because of Adam's stroke, right? So your child's on a hunger strike, and you're locking away the food? Paul's response, okay. If you disagree, please say so, but he is not going to win this. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. She was bound and determined that she was going to win. Timothy was no longer a human to her. Timothy was something even below the dogs that she trained, but she was going to make sure that she won this fight. Ladies and gentlemen, it is now up to you to send a message to her that she lost this fight. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Roberts. Yes? Good? Okay. Can you use the restroom?
No, sir.
Okay, all right. All right.
Members of the jury, the evidence and the arguments in this case have finished, and I will now instruct you on the law. That is, I will explain the law that applies to this case. Remember that you have taken an oath to return a true and a just verdict based only on the evidence and my instructions on the law. You must not let sympathy or prejudice influence your decision. As jurors, you must decide what the facts of this case are. This is your job and no one else's. You must think about all the evidence and the testimony and then decide what each piece of evidence means and how important you think it is. This includes whether you believe what each of the witnesses said. What you decide about any fact in this case is final. It's my duty to instruct you on the law. You must take the law as I give it to you. If a lawyer says something different about the law, follow what I say. At various times, I have given you some instructions about the law. You must take all of my instructions together as the law you are to follow. You should not pay attention to some instructions and then ignore others. To sum up, it's your job to decide what the facts of this case are, to apply the law as I give it to you, and in that way decide this case. As I've repeatedly said, a person accused of a crime is presumed to be innocent. This means that you must start with the presumption that the defendant is innocent. This presumption continues throughout the trial and entitles the defendant to a verdict of not guilty unless you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that she is guilty. Every crime is made up of parts called elements. The prosecutor must prove each element of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant is not required to prove her innocence or to do anything. If you find that the prosecutor has not proven every element beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must find the defendant not guilty. A reasonable doubt is a fair and honest doubt growing out of the evidence or lack of evidence. It's not merely an imaginary or a possible doubt, but a doubt based on reason and common sense. A reasonable doubt is just that, a doubt that is reasonable after a careful and considered examination of the facts and circumstances of this case. When you decide this case and decide on your verdict, you may only consider the evidence that has been properly admitted in this case. Therefore, it's important for you to understand what is evidence and what is not evidence. Evidence includes only the sworn testimony of witnesses, the exhibits admitted into evidence, and anything that I have told you to consider as evidence. Many things are not evidence, and you must be careful not to consider them as such. I will now describe some of the things that are not evidence. The fact that the defendant is charged with a crime and is on trial is not evidence. The lawyer's statements and arguments are not evidence. They are only meant to help you understand the evidence and each side's legal theories. The lawyer's question to witnesses are also not evidence. You should consider these questions only as they give meaning to the witness's answers. You should only accept things the lawyers say that are supported by the evidence or by your own common sense and general knowledge. My comments, rulings, questions, and instructions are also not evidence. It's my duty to see that the trial is conducted according to the law and to tell you the law that applies to this case. However, when I make a comment or give an instructions, I am not trying to influence your vote or express a personal opinion about the case. If you believe that I have an opinion about how you should decide this case, you must pay no attention to that opinion. You are the only judges of the facts, and you should decide this case from the evidence. At times during the trial, I have excluded evidence that was offered or stricken testimony that was heard. Do not consider those things in deciding the case. Make your decision only on the evidence that I let in and nothing else. Your decision should be based on all of the evidence, regardless of which party produced it. You should use your own common sense and general knowledge in weighing and judging the evidence, but you should not use any personal knowledge you may have about a place, person, or event. To repeat once more, you must decide this case based only on the evidence admitted during this trial. As I said before, it's your job to decide what the facts of this case are. You must decide which witnesses you believe and how important you think their testimony is. You do not have to accept or reject everything a witness said. You're free to believe all, none, or part of any person's testimony. In deciding which testimony you believe, you should rely on your own common sense and everyday experience. However, in deciding whether you believe a witness's testimony, you must set aside any bias or prejudice you may have based on race, gender, national origin of the witness. There's no fixed set of rules for judging whether you believe a witness, but it may help you to think about the following questions. Was the witness able to see or hear clearly? How long was the witness watching or listening? Was anything else going on that may have distracted the witness? Did the witness seem to have a good memory? How did the witness look and act while testifying? Did the witness seem to be making an honest effort to tell the truth, or did the witness seem to evade the questions or argue with the lawyers? Does a witness's age and maturity affect how you judge his or her testimony? Does a witness have any bias, prejudice, or personal interest in how this case is decided? Have there been any promises, threats, suggestions, or other influences that affected how the witness testified? In general, does a witness have any special reason to tell the truth or any special reason to lie? All in all, how reasonable does a witness's testimony seem when you think about all the other evidence in the case? Sometimes the testimony of different witnesses will not agree, and you must decide which testimony you accept. You should think about whether the disagreement involves something important or not, and whether you think someone is lying or simply mistaken. People see and hear things differently, and witnesses may testify honestly but simply be wrong about what they thought they saw or remembered. It's also a good idea to think about which testimony agrees best with the other evidence in the case. However, you may conclude that a witness deliberately lied about something that is important to how you decide the case. If so, you may choose not to accept anything that witness said. On the other hand, if you think the witness lied about some things but told the truth about others, you may simply accept the part you think is true and ignore the rest. The prosecution has introduced evidence of a statement that it claims the defendant made. Before you may consider such an out-of-court statement against the defendant, you must first find that the defendant actually made the statement as given to you. If you find that the defendant did make the statement, you may give the statement whatever weight you think it deserves. In deciding this, you should think about how and when the statement was made, and about all the other evidence in the case. You may consider the statement in deciding the facts of the case and in deciding if you believe the defendant's testimony in court. Facts can be proven by direct evidence from a witness or exhibit. Direct evidence is evidence about what we actually see or hear. For example, if you were to look outside and see rain falling, that would be direct evidence that it's raining. Facts can also be proved by indirect or circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence is evidence that normally or reasonably leads to other facts. So in my example, if you were to see a person come in from the outside wearing a raincoat covered with small drops of water, that would be circumstantial evidence that it's raining. You may consider circumstantial evidence. Circumstantial evidence by itself, or a combination of circumstantial evidence and direct evidence, can be used to prove the elements of a crime. In other words, you should consider all the evidence that you believe. You have heard evidence that before the trial, a witness made a statement that may be inconsistent with her testimony or his testimony here in court. You may consider an inconsistent statement made before the trial to help you decide how believable the witness's testimony was when testifying here in court. If the earlier statement was made under oath, then you may also consider the earlier statement as evidence of the truth or of whatever the witness said in the earlier statement when determining the facts of this case. You may consider whether the defendant had a reason to commit the alleged crime, but a reason by itself is not enough to find a person guilty of a crime. The prosecutor does not have to prove that the defendant had a reason to commit the alleged crime. He only has to show that the defendant actually committed the crime and that she meant to do so. You should not decide this case based on which side presented more witnesses. Instead, you should think about each witness and each piece of evidence and whether you believe them. Then you must decide whether the testimony and the evidence you believe proves beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty. You have heard that a lawyer or a lawyer's representative talked to one of the witnesses. There's nothing wrong with this. A lawyer or lawyer's representative may talk to a witness to find out what the witness knows about the case and what the witness's testimony will be. You have also heard testimony from a witness, a Dr. Joyce DeYoung, who has given you her opinion as an expert in the field of forensic pathology. Experts are allowed to give opinions in court about matters they are experts on. However, you do not have to believe an expert's testimony or opinion. Instead, you should decide whether you believe it and how important you think it is. When you decide whether you believe an expert's opinion, think carefully about the reasons and facts she gave for her opinion and whether those facts are true. You should also think about the expert's qualifications and whether her opinion makes sense when you think about the other evidence in this case. You have heard testimony from witnesses who are police officers. That testimony is to be judged by the same standards as used to evaluate the testimony of any other witness. The defendant is charged with counts, that is, with the separate crimes of homicide, open murder, and first-degree child abuse. These are separate crimes, and the prosecutor is charging that the defendant committed all of them. You must consider each crime separately in light of all the evidence in the case. The defendant is charged with first-degree felony murder. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant caused the death of Timothy Ferguson. That is, that Timothy Ferguson died as a result of starvation and or physical neglect and abuse. Second, that the defendant had one of these three states of mind. She intended to kill, or she intended to do great bodily harm to Timothy Ferguson, or she knowingly created a very high risk of death or great bodily harm, knowing that death or such harm would be the likely result of her actions. Third, that when she did the act that caused the death of Timothy Ferguson, the defendant was committing or attempting to commit or helping someone else commit the crime of first-degree child abuse. The elements of the first-degree child abuse must be proven by the prosecutor beyond a reasonable doubt, and those elements include the following. First, that Shanda Vander Ark is the parent of Timothy Ferguson. Second, that the defendant either knowingly or intentionally caused serious physical harm and or serious mental harm to Timothy Ferguson. Third, that Timothy Ferguson was at the time under the age of 18. By serious physical harm, I mean any physical injury to a child that seriously impairs the child's health or physical well-being, including but not limited to brain damage, a skull or bone fracture, subdural hemorrhage or hematoma, dislocation, sprain, internal injury, poisoning, burn, or scald, or severe cut. By serious mental harm, I mean an injury to a child's mental condition that results in visible signs of an impairment in the child's judgment, behavior, ability to recognize reality, or ability to cope with the ordinary demands of life. The fourth element of first-degree felony murder is that the killing was not justified, excused, or done under circumstances that would reduce it to a lesser crime. Determining whether the act causing death occurred while the defendant was committing or attempting to commit or helping someone else commit the crime of first-degree child abuse, you should consider the following. One, the length of time between the commission of first-degree child abuse and the murder. Second, the distance between the scene of the first-degree child abuse and the scene of the murder. Third, whether there is a causal connection between the murder and first-degree child abuse. Fourth, whether there is a continuity of action between first-degree child abuse and the murder. Fifth, whether the murder was committed during an attempt to escape. You may also consider the lesser charge of second-degree murder. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant caused the death of Timothy Ferguson. That is, that Timothy Ferguson died as a result of starvation and or physical neglect and abuse. Second, that the defendant had one of these three states of mind. She intended to kill, or she intended to do great bodily harm to Timothy Ferguson, or she knowingly created a very high risk of death or great bodily harm, knowing that death or such harm would be the likely result of her actions. Third, that the killing was not justified, excused, or done under circumstances that reduce it to a lesser crime. You may also consider the lesser charge of involuntary manslaughter. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant caused the death of Timothy Ferguson. That is, that Timothy Ferguson died as a result of starvation and or physical neglect and abuse. Second, in doing the act that caused Timothy Ferguson's death, the defendant acted in a grossly negligent manner. Gross negligence means more than carelessness. It means willfully disregarding the result to others that might follow from an act or failure to act. In order to find that the defendant was grossly negligent, you must find each of the following three things beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the defendant knew of the danger to another. That is, she knew there was a situation that required her to take ordinary care to avoid injuring another. Second, that the defendant could have avoided injuring another by using ordinary care. Third, that the defendant failed to use ordinary care to prevent injuring another when, to a reasonable person, it must have been apparent that the result was likely to be a serious injury. The defendant is also charged with a crime of first-degree child abuse. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that Shanda Vander Ark is the parent of Timothy Ferguson. Second, that the defendant either knowingly or intentionally caused serious physical harm and or serious mental harm to Timothy Ferguson. by serious physical harm, I mean any physical injury to a child that seriously impairs a child's health or physical well-being, including but not limited to brain damage, a skull or bone fracture, subdural hemorrhage or hematoma, dislocation, sprain, internal injury, poisoning, burn or scald, or severe cut. By serious mental harm, I mean an injury to a child's mental condition that results in visible signs of an impairment in the child's judgment, behavior, ability to recognize reality, or ability to cope with the ordinary demands of life. Third, that Timothy Ferguson was at the time under the age of 18. It's not a crime to discipline a child. A parent may use force to discipline a child, but this does not mean that any amount of force may be used. The law permits only such force as is reasonable. The defendant is not required to prove that the acts alleged here were reasonable. The prosecutor must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the force used was not reasonable as discipline. The defendant's intent may be proved by what she said, what she did, how she did it, or by any other facts and circumstances and evidence. You must think about all the evidence in deciding what the defendant's state of mind was at the time of the alleged killing. The defendant's state of mind may be inferred from the kind of weapon used, the type of wounds inflicted, the acts and words of the defendant, and any other circumstances surrounding the alleged killing. In this case, the defendant is charged with committing open murder and first-degree child abuse or intentionally assisting someone else in committing it. Anyone who intentionally assists someone in committing a crime is as guilty as the person who directly commits it and can be convicted of that crime as an aider and abettor. To prove this charge, the prosecutor must prove each of the following elements beyond a reasonable doubt. First, that the alleged crime was actually committed either by the defendant or someone else. Does not matter whether anyone else has been convicted of that crime. Second, that before or during that crime, the defendant did something to assist, counsel, aid, or abet the commission of the crime. Third, at the time the defendant must have intended the commission of the crime alleged, or must have known that the other person intended its commission, or that the crime alleged was a natural and probable consequence of the commission of the crime intended. It does not matter how much help, advice, or encouragement the defendant gave. However, you must decide whether the defendant intended to help another commit the crime and whether her help, advice, or encouragement actually did help, advise, or encourage the crime. The evidence must convince you beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime occurred on or about July 6, 2022 within Muskegon County. When you go to the jury room, you will be provided with a written copy of the final jury instructions. You should first choose a foreperson. The foreperson should see to it that your discussions are carried on in a businesslike way and that everyone has a fair chance to be heard. During your deliberations, please turn off your cell phones or other communications equipment until we recess. A verdict in a criminal case must be unanimous. In order to return a verdict, it is not necessary that each of you agrees on that verdict. In the jury room, you will discuss the case among yourselves, but ultimately, each of you will have to make up your own individual mind. Any verdict must represent the individual considered judgment of each juror. It's your duty as jurors to talk to each other and make every reasonable effort to reach an agreement. Express your opinions and the reason for them, but keep an open mind as you listen to your fellow jurors. Rethink your opinions and do not hesitate to change your mind if you decide that you were wrong. Try to work out your differences. However, although you should try to reach an agreement, none of you should give up your own honest opinion about the case just because the other jurors disagree with you or just for the sake of reaching a verdict. In the end, your vote must be your own and you must vote honestly and in good conscience. If you have any question about the jury instructions before you begin deliberations or questions about the instructions that arise during deliberations, you may submit them in writing to the bailiff. Possible penalties should not influence your decision. It's the duty of the judge to fix the penalty within the limits provided by the law. If you have any questions or wish to communicate with me while you're in the jury room, please have your foreperson write a note and give it to the bailiff. It's not proper for you to talk directly to the judge, lawyers, court officers, or other people involved in the case. As you discuss the case, you must not let anyone, even me, know how your voting stands. Therefore, until you return with a unanimous verdict, do not reveal this to anyone outside the jury room. When you go to the jury room to deliberate, you are permitted to take your notes and full instructions. If you want to look at any or all of the reference documents or exhibits that have been admitted, you simply need to ask for them. When you go to the jury room, you'll be given a copy of the written instructions that I've just read. As you discuss the case, you should think about all of my instructions together as a law you are to follow. When you do the note, there's a doorbell back there. I think you guys have already seen it. If you have a question, write it down, fold it in half. Just ring the doorbell. Mr. Weaver will come in. He'll say, we have a question. Do we have a verdict? He'll ask you. You say, yep, here's a question. He'll bring that back out. Give us a few minutes. Essentially, we do questions on the record, okay? So we don't just all gather in chambers and answer the question and then send it back in there. We want to make sure there's a record that what question was asked. So typically, it takes us a little minute to get everything assembled again, and then we'll bring you back in if we can answer the question, and we'll actually answer it in open court, okay? So that's kind of the process, and again, please be patient. It's not as simple as it comes to me, I write down the answer, and I send it back. There's a little more to it. So I have prepared a verdict form listing the possible verdicts. Verdict form that you'll receive says State of Michigan, the 14th Circuit Court, People of the State of Michigan versus Shonda Vander Ark, has my name, the file number. It says verdict form, possible verdicts. You may return only one verdict on each count. Mark only one verdict for each count. Count one is charging open murder involving the death of Timothy Ferguson. There's boxes for not guilty, guilty of first-degree felony murder, guilty of lesser offense of second-degree murder, and guilty of lesser offense of involuntary manslaughter. Count two is first-degree child abuse, and there's two boxes, not guilty and guilty. Under each count, you are only permitted to mark one box. That's important. And it says that on there, but sometimes it happens. So, and then on the bottom, it says date, and whoever the foreperson is, just date it and sign it. If you reach a verdict, then simply, again, take it, fold the verdict form in half, ring the doorbell, tell Mr. Weaver. Do not give him the verdict form. You hang on to that. What will happen is we'll bring the jury out. Whoever that foreperson is, I'll essentially address the jury and say, if that's a verdict, would the foreperson please rise? They'll read that. Mr. Weaver will collect that from whoever the foreperson is, give it to me so I may review it, and then we'll give it back to whoever the foreperson is to pronounce the verdict in open court. That's a procedure we'll follow. So at this time, we need to do our blind draw to slim our jury down to 12. You could do that, Mr. Weaver.
Juror number three.
Okay. You know what? I usually have my list up here, and for some reason, oh, wait a minute, hold on. Mr. Crowley. Wherever the alternate is. Actually, why don't we just call the alternate before we do that?
Number one.
Okay, Ms. In any case, quite frankly, the alternates, typically what we'll do is I'm directing you not to talk about this case with anyone. We do that because potentially something could happen during deliberations. We now only have 12. And if somebody goes down and you guys have talked about the case or started looking up information, it creates a problem because we may bring you back to say, okay, we've lost a 12th juror. We need one in here and bring you in, okay? I want you to go through the door here when you're excused. Ms. Deaton will get your phone numbers. And if the jury reaches a verdict or when this case is done, Mr. Weaver will call you and simply say you are now free to talk about this case with anyone you wish, okay? So at this time, I'll have you go with, well, before we do that, you want to have him, and then you'll come back out, or what do you want to do?
I just bring him back to Ms. Steve.
Okay, so they're bring back, he's got to come back out so I can swear him in, but if you go ahead and go with Mr. Weaver right now, he'll take care of you. Solemnly swear that you will, to the utmost of your ability, keep the person sworn as jurors on this trial from separating from each other, that you will not suffer any communications to be made to them or any of them, orally or otherwise, that you will not communicate with them or any of them orally or otherwise except by the order of this court, or ask them if they have agreed upon their verdict until they shall be discharged, and you will not, before they render their verdict, communicate to any person the state of their deliberations or the verdict they have agreed, so help you God.
I swear.
All right, put your hand down. All right, with that, ladies and gentlemen, I will have you go ahead and follow Mr. Weaver to the jury room. If you need the exhibits and say so, we will give you the verdict form and the instructions here in just a moment. Reflect the jury's down in the jury room. Anything before you have, Mr. Roberts, do you have all the exhibits collected?
I do have the exhibits collected, okay. And I actually do have a statement as it relates to one of those, the final exhibit that we marked, and we had a discussion about it being admitted, and certainly it was by stipulation, but and now we are just going to stipulate that number 45, that was the recording that was made,
okay.
And was admitted.
Okay.
Otherwise, yes, all the exhibits.
Mr. Johnson, any objection to that?
I do not have an objection to that.
Okay, we actually have a laptop that they are allowed to use, so I guess sometimes I just send in the exhibits to kind of save time, but any objection to just simply doing that?
I would prefer, yes.
Okay.
That was on a flash drive.
Oh, okay. All right, so what we'll do is we'll simply send in the exhibits as well as our laptop, which prevents them from accessing the internet and all that.
Do we want them to send in the hot sauce?
There are a couple of the other physical exhibits are actually in Mr. Weaver's office, I believe. Anyway.
So yeah, I mean, it's not a weapon. I mean, typically I'm concerned about weapons or drugs. But
from the description, I'm not sure that's accurate.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have an objection to it unless somebody has some serious objection. They seem like pretty responsible people not to start tampering with stuff. So Mr. Weaver can maybe just suggest they not take it out of bags or anything. You do that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anything else for the record, Mr. Roberts?
No, Judge. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson?
No, sir, and thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, gentlemen. All right. Just kind of stay in the area in case we have an early question. So.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Any jury instructions?
Yeah, I have them given to you. Actually, here, if you want to.
There's more to come in the trial of Shanda Vander Ark. Here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Stay with us.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand-new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand-new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand-new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand-new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.